This is Law and Disorder.
Joining us today is San Francisco attorney Mark Vanderhout. Just days after the 20th anniversary of the arrest of the so-called LA 8, on January 31st, immigration judge Bruce Einhorn ordered an end to the proceedings against Qadir Hamid and Michelle Shahada, members of the LA 8. We'll talk with the author of the book King Leopold's Ghost on the parallels between the genocide in the Congo and what the U.S. is doing in Iraq.
Adam Hochschild has written this gem, and President Bush made the mistake of telling a reporter that he was reading it.
We'll also hear more from Michael Schwartz in a speech that covers a range of problems with the U.S. involvement in Iraq. In one of the most compelling speeches we've recorded, we'll hear Margaret Prescott's support for Lieutenant Watada's case.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. Happy to have here on Law and Disorder Adam Hochschild, the award-winning American writer. He's currently teaching writing at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley. He's written a number of well-received, including the widely awarded King Leopold's Ghost. And it was because George Bush, in an answer to a reporter, said that, yes, what I'm reading now is King Leopold's Ghost, that occasioned Adam Hochschild's op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times and brings him here to Law and Disorder. Adam Hochschild, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's good to be with you.
I couldn't believe it. I read the letter you had written to the editor on Bush's comment when someone asked him what he was reading. I wasn't even aware that people asked him that because with Bush, you're not even sure you're going to get an answer or that he reads at all. But what was so stunning to me was that he said, I'm reading Adam Hochschild's book, King Leopold's Ghost. I remember having read it 2 years ago. Michael Ratner and I were talking about it because it was just such an excellent historical study from the point of view of a radical that went really to the roots of what Belgian colonialism was. And when Bush said that he was reading that book, I couldn't believe it. And it gave you, of course, the opportunity to discuss the irony of Bush and his cohorts and what they're doing in Iraq and his talking about reading a book on the Belgian Congo. So let me ask you this. What was it that caused you to write the book on King Leopold?
Well, the story I tell in King Leopold's Ghost is really the story of what is probably the single bloodiest episode in the European colonization of Africa, which was a pretty bloody business to begin with, as conquests generally are. What happened was that King Leopold II of Belgium, who was a very greedy, very ambitious, very smart, very charming man, felt he had the misfortune to be the king of a rather small country. And moreover, he was king at a time in history, the late 19th century, when it wasn't so much fun to be a king anymore because you had all this nonsense of parliaments and voters and so forth, and he couldn't really exercise absolute power the way he wanted to. So he wanted to get himself a colony. Interestingly, Belgium as a country was not particularly interested in acquiring an African colony. People felt it was an extravagance for a small country with no navy and no merchant marine. King said, no problem, I'll get my own colony. And so for the first 23 years of its existence as a recognized international territory.
Adam Hochschild, you've been following, I'm sure, the course of America's adventure in Iraq. And what parallels would you make? What lessons do you learn from what was done to the people of the Congo and what's being done to the people in Iraq?
Well, there are many differences, but some similarities. I think one similarity, of course, is that most acts of conquest in history happen when the territory involved has some very valuable natural resource that's coveted by somebody else. In the Congo, it was rubber, and also ivory was very important as well. In Iraq, it's obviously oil. Periodically, Vice President Cheney or somebody else goes on TV and says, this war is not about oil. But to anybody who says this war is not about oil, I would pose this question. Iraq has 10 to 12% of the estimated world reserves of oil. What if instead Iraq had 10 to 20% of the estimated world reserves of turnips or cantaloupe or kiwi fruit? Would there be 140,000 U.S. troops there? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's the joke people made about why they're not in North Korea, because what does North Korea have? Cabbage.
That's right. That's a major similarity, that it's a natural resource that is driving this thing.
Adam, let's go back to Bush saying he was reading your book, and tell us a bit about your op-ed piece.
Well, I can read you parts of it.
Please.
I saw this article in the Washington Post that said that he'd been reading my book. I didn't know whether to believe it. I think we all feel a little skeptical when President Bush claims that he's read a book. But, you know, a writer is glad to get readers wherever they are to be found.
Even if he reads your book upside down.
Yeah. I wrote him a letter, which was published in the L.A. Times, and I can read you a few pieces of it.
We'd be delighted to hear it.
Okay. I said, Dear Mr. President, your interview in the Washington Post made headlines across the country, but it caught my eye for a different reason, where you explained that the most recent book you read was King Leopold's Ghost, about the plundering of the Congo a century ago. This pleased me because I wrote that book. Sometimes college history classes that read King Leopold's Ghost invite me in for a seminar. But before you ask Carl to call me, however, let me just say that this is a busy time of year for us both. But instead, let me raise a few follow-up questions with you here. The first question I ask him relates to just what we were talking about. First, as you know, the long effort by King Leopold II of Belgium to bring the Congo under his control was driven by his avid quest for a commodity central to industry and transportation of his day, rubber. Does that remind you of anything? Then I go on and say, what's more, the king justified his grab for Congo's natural resources with much talk about bringing philanthropy and Christianity to darkest Africa. Now, what did that remind you of? And then finally, Leopold cleared at least $1.1 billion in today's dollars during the 23 years he controlled the Congo, and his businessmen friends made additional huge sums. Much of that money flowed into companies with special royal concession rights to exploit the rainforest. Final question for extra credit, do these companies remind you of anything? If you mentioned Halliburton or DynCorp, you're right again. So those are some of the things I said to Mr. Bush.
What was the reaction around the country to your op-ed piece in the L.A. Times?
Well, a friend wrote to me. I heard nothing from the White House, unfortunately. Did get reprinted various places. A friend wrote to me, I didn't know your book was out as a classic comic, because she assumed that was the only way Bush would have read it. Got a few other responses like that. But I'm still waiting to hear back from him or Karl Rove. I have a feeling he may have a few other things on his mind, though.
Adam, I'd like to go back to the issue of the forced labor. Were there any other human rights violations also going on there?
Oh, absolutely, because as in all of colonial Africa, people essentially had no rights at all. European country involved, Belgium or Leopold's private regime, in this case Britain, France, Germany, Portugal, just came in and ran the place. Nobody could vote. what you could even say in public or say in print if you were lucky enough to be one of the relatively few Africans who had any degree of schooling was sharply limited. And that kind of lack of right to vote, lack of free speech in the press and so forth really remained right up until the final days of colonialism.
I thought the most horrific thing was the amputations that were so freely practiced against the African people.
This was a practice that originated in this fashion. When the only way that Leopold could control this whole territory and make it produce the rubber and ivory that he wanted was, of course, through brute force. He had this army that I mentioned of 19,000 officers and men, black conscripts, white officers. As in many colonial situations, the colonial power is always very uneasy about just whose side the army is going to be on. Actually, you see the same thing right now, where the U.S. really can't control the Iraqi army, and we're sometimes synonymous with the Shiite militias.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the Congo, what happened was that the white officers would dole out only a limited number of bullets to the army when they went on expeditions hunting down rebels against the regime, and there were many, many rebellions. And in order to prove that they had not wasted the bullet in hunting, or worse yet, saved it to use in a mutiny against their officers, every soldier was supposed to bring to his officer a severed hand from the dead body of the rebel that he had killed with the bullet that was issued to him. And, of course, soldiers did sometimes shoot and miss or saved the bullet, to use for something else or whatever. And then they would go hack a hand off a living person so as to have something to bring back to their officers.
Well, it's spreading Christian civilization. You could make the same parallels with what they're doing to the people in Iraq. I just wanted to close, Adam Hochschild, with this observation. The U.S. originally brought sanctions against Iraq in the 90s. It was reported that some 600,000 children died as a consequence of the U.S. sanctions. And several months ago, Lancet, the British medical journal, reported that another some 600,000 people have probably died since the United States invaded Iraq. So I think that the kind of study that you made in King Leopold's Ghost of what happened in this colonizing mission and ripoff of the Congo a century ago is precisely what's going on in Iraq.
Well, and, you know, the sad thing is that in both cases, because the lives of the people involved are not considered all that important to the occupying powers, we will never really know any exact numbers at all. We can make estimates in both cases. Nobody is keeping count.
Adam, I think it's worth pointing out that when you submitted the manuscript, 9 out of 10 U.S. publishing houses refused, and then it went on to become an unexpected bestseller. Adam, thank you so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
Adam, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Just days after the 20th anniversary of the arrest of the so-called L.A. 8, on January 31st, immigration judge Bruce Einhorn ordered an end to the proceedings against Qadir Hamid and Michelle Shahada, members of the L.A. 8. The government has been seeking to deport Hamid and Shahada since January 1987, based on their alleged support for the Popular Liberation Front for Palestine, a group within the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The judge terminated the proceedings because the government refused to comply with his 2005 pretrial order to turn over exculpatory evidence regarding Hamid and Shahada's alleged support for the PFLP. Joining us today is San Francisco attorney Mark Vanderhout of the law firm Vanderhout, Brigaliano & Nightingale. Mark has been representing the LA 8 on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild since the case began 20 years ago. Mark, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Heidi.
You know, Mark, this is Michael Smith. Remember you and I met for the first time 22 years ago when we were over in Israel together.
That long ago.
It was that long ago. And then this case is so old that I remember you started working on this case 2 years after that. This is a 20-year-old case. This case has spanned our entire relationship.
More or last the entire adult life of all the, what they call the respondents, or what might be known as defendants in the case, and their whole lives of all their children, obviously.
Now, Mark, we're talking about really an historic trial. Can you tell us how you got involved in this initially, and who else worked with you on the case?
I got a call in January of 1987, probably the day after the arrests. Several National Lawyers Guild attorneys in Los Angeles had gotten together to help out with the arrests of the LA-8 the day, essentially, that the arrests were made, because it was huge news in the papers and the press. There was probably hundreds of law enforcement officers, helicopters over people's houses, and the LA Herald Examiner had banner headlines in the paper, "War on Terrorism Hits LA." And so there was a lot of concern. The Guild lawyers down there rallied to the defense of these individuals, and I got a call to ask if I would come down and help out, which I did a couple of days later. And there was a group of lawyers at that point, all from the National Lawyers Guild, but within a couple of days, the ACLU of Southern California got involved also, and there was a real good team put together. Within a month or so after that, I called David Cole from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he got involved also, and so there was a very strong legal team. Initially, Ramsey Clark, Len Wineglass. There was probably about 15 lawyers initially on the case. As time went on, and the case dragged through the courts and dragged through the years, the team got, you know, I'd say, more consolidated. And it's essentially been myself for the Guild, David for the Center for Constitutional Rights, and then more recently the ACLU of Southern California through Ahilana Ulanantham got back involved and has been doing the case last couple of years with us. Lenny Wineglass over the years. And also, we've had a tremendous non-attorney but essential part of the team, Phyllis Bennis, who's been the investigator on the case, has worked on this case for 20 years with us also.
She's been a guest on the show. And for 20 years, the government's been trying to deport these people.
That's true. This is one of the most horrendous waste of government resources in cases where an individual, none of these individuals has ever been accused of any crime. Matter of fact, when William Webster, who was the head of the FBI at the time and was being confirmed as head of the FBI, was asked at his confirmation hearings in a congressional inquiry why the government was going after the LA-8 and whether there was any criminal activity or terrorist activity involved, he said no. He said the FBI did a 3-year investigation. They had people sleeping next door in apartments, renting apartments next door to Hunter Hamidi and Julie Mungai, had surveillance, FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act surveillance for years on them. Not a single crime could they get them with. And what happened, Webster said, look, they've done nothing illegal, but we turned it over to the INS to see if we could deport them under immigration laws because we don't like what they're doing. They were distributing magazines for the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, one of the groups within the PLO, and they were speaking out. Most importantly, they were effective organizers in Southern California for the rights of Palestinians in this country and for speaking out about the rights of Palestinians to have a homeland abroad.
So essentially, this is also a First Amendment case.
It's all it's been since day one. Judge Wilson, the district court judge who reviewed all the evidence in camera that the government had when they claimed that they had all this secret information that they couldn't reveal in public because it would thwart the war on terrorism, he made them submit it in camera. He looked at it, and in a published decision, he went through it, and he said, this is all First Amendment protected activity. There's nothing here that's illegal. If they provide material support to a terrorist organization in furtherance of its terrorist activity. When the law was passed, we didn't have a problem with that. We thought, okay, if people are supporting terrorism and funding terrorism and involved in actual bombings and kidnappings, etc., sure, the government has the right to deport them. But what the government did is they took a provision in the law in 1990, which still is in the law today, that says, defines terrorist activity little as trying to attempt to use a gun to endanger property. And then the government took another provision in the law that said material support of a terrorist organization is fundraising for a terrorist organization. And what their bottom line position has been is if you raise money for schools, for charities, for daycare centers, for hospitals, for newspapers of an organization that also has a military component to it, and that military component, would obviously use a gun to endanger property, then you have committed a terrorist act. That's the government's position. So they took the exact allegations in this case, distributing newspapers for the PFLP, and when the law was changed in 1990, they said, okay, you're now deportable for terrorist activity. What is that terrorist activity? Distributing magazines for the PFLP, because that provides material support to a quote-unquote terrorist organization, a terrorist organization being defined as any organization that engages in terrorist activity being defined as using a gun.
Mark, let's fast forward to the recent decision by Judge Einhorn. Basically, he had ordered the prosecution, the government, to turn over potentially exculpatory evidence, and they stalled on that. That was part of the reason he threw this out, right?
That is correct. What happened was we were prepared to go to trial last July, and at that point in time, we were about a week before trial when the immigration judge had a telephonic conference and said, where's the government's evidence? We ordered you to produce it. We're ready to go to trial. Where's the evidence? And they hadn't produced it. Not only had they produced it, but they had filed a declaration from someone in the Justice Department saying, well, this is our definition of exculpatory evidence, and this is what we think we have to do, and this is what we look for, which is entirely different than the judge had ordered. The judge called off the trial. He said, what am I going to do? I can't go forward. The defendants don't have a right to defend themselves. He called off the trial, and then ultimately we did a motion to dismiss. A motion to dismiss was based in part on the government not complying with the judge's order. But more importantly, it was that this case had been going on for 20 years. Government went to Congress three times to change the law. We cannot get a fair trial 20 years later.
Mark, let me read for our listening audience, and we're speaking here with attorney Mark Vanderhoot, who played a key role in freeing the Los Angeles Eight. And in the decision that Judge Einhorn wrote dismissing the case, it begins with this quote, "The attenuation of these proceedings is a festering wound on the body of respondents and an embarrassment to the rule of law."
He was very upset. He felt, bottom line, look, 20 years later, we're supposed to go to trial and the judgment. Government still doesn't have its evidence together, still didn't present us with all the evidence that they were going to prove, forgetting the exculpatory evidence. The evidence that they needed to submit in their case in chief, they didn't provide to us in a timely fashion so we could represent Hutter and Michelle and properly defend them. And the judge said, 20 years later, you still don't have it together.
Mark, you practice immigration law.
Right.
Tell us why the judge's decision is important for other immigrants in this country who wish to go out and express their political views.
Well, what finally the judge said, and it was a very courageous decision because he was a Justice Department appointee, don't forget, and the Justice Department through the FBI was the one that was prosecuting this case for 20 years. And the judge said, look, bottom line, if you've got evidence and you think these are terrorists, what are you doing letting terrorists roam free in this country for 20 years? And what he really was saying between the lines was, everybody knows this case is not about terrorism. Judge Wilson looked at this. No terrorist activity, no criminal activity. This is all about First Amendment protected activity. And you, government, 20 years later, still can't present any evidence that these people have committed a crime or committed a deportable offense. Enough's enough.
The case is also about, with the struggle going on between the colonial power, Israel, and the Palestine people, this case is also about the United States government coming down on the side against the Palestine people here in the United States when they try to speak out in support of their people in their homeland.
That's what this case has been about since day one. And matter of fact, after they brought the charges again, after the McCarran-Walter Act was thrown out and they brought the charges again, we pursued in the district court and ultimately through the Ninth Circuit, and unfortunately the government took it to the Supreme Court, but a selective prosecution claim. And what we said is, look, the only reason these people are, the government's trying to deport them, is because of who they support. They support the PLO. U.S. government was against. U.S. government was aligned with Israel, obviously, and the U.S. government didn't like these people who were effective organizers for a Palestinian homeland. And what our selective prosecution claim said is, look, there's people in this country who the United States is allowing to be here, financing the Contras in their support of against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the late 70s and early 80s, the anti-Castro Cubanos, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who at that point we were supporting. And we presented evidence saying, even if they had done anything wrong, which they hadn't, the government's engaging in selective prosecution because they're prosecuting the LEA solely because they support an entity the United States doesn't like. And we won that case. We won that case in district court. We won at the Court of Appeals. Justice Barrett went to Congress after we won and got the law changed and said you cannot bring a selective prosecution challenge in an immigration case. Congress passed that in 1996. They applied it retroactively to all pending cases, of which there was
That's
one.
That's astounding.
The LA-8. And we went to court, got that declared unlawful, won that at the Ninth Circuit. The government then took that to the Supreme Court, and in a horrendous decision in 1999, the Supreme Court said immigrants don't have a right to bring a selective prosecution case to defend themselves.
Unbelievable. Another message the judge sent to everyone with his decision is that the government needs to more wisely allocate its resources to pursuing genuine threats to national security instead of going after law-abiding immigrants who haven't done anything wrong.
That's exactly right. And that's what people are really saying now. And that's really what the judge was saying in his decision.
We want to thank you, congratulate you again. We've been speaking with Mark Vanderhoot, National Lawyers Guild attorney, a terrific immigration lawyer. I tell you, Mark, on behalf of Heidi and myself, if we ever face deportation, we're calling you.
Well, right now they're not trying to deport U.S. citizens, but you never know.
You never know.
Let me say one other thing, if I can.
Sure.
Out of time. We'd like people to write Michael Chertoff, the head of Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. Just write that, Washington, D.C., Department of Homeland Security. Say enough is enough. This case should not be appealed. These people have done nothing illegal. Go after real terrorism.
Mark, we could do that, and we can put that up on our website.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Take care. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Dream. Ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back and chained. To deny us of the future, rob our name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me. Cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me. Promised me freedom, education, equality. Never gave me nothing but slavery. And now look at how dangerous you made me. Calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold. With this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told. Promised me emancipation and this new nation. All you ever gave my people were salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lying about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power.
Anti-war activists crammed into a small fifth-floor abandoned office in downtown Manhattan to confront and discuss the recent escalation of troops and funding of the Iraq War. Mostly standing, they listened to Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. In his talk, Schwartz says that the United States is fomenting sectarian violence in Iraq by fighting two sides. Schwartz also comments on a speech that Illinois Senator Barack Obama delivered regarding Iraq and the withdrawal of troops.
Okay, I want to amplify on especially one of the things that Anthony just said, which is about the U.S. being the cause of the violence in Iraq. I think that this is one of the enduring issues, and even people, a lot of people who are very much against this war, are saying, well, we can't leave now because if we leave, there will be this horrendous civil war. They'll unleash all these things. The Americans are the only thing standing between between Iraq and a complete meltdown. And I think we have to get a very good understanding of what is so profoundly wrong with that image, even though it's a very plausible kind of image because we've seen all these places around the world where there's been these horrific civil wars that have amounted to genocide, so it's very easy to imagine it in Iraq. Instead of the U.S. being the only thing standing between Iraq and a civil war, we have to understand that the American military is fomenting a civil war in Iraq, is creating and constructing it on a daily basis. And when Bush says he's going to send 20,000 more troops, this is not something that is going to suppress a civil war. It's going to be like pouring oil on a fire. Because wherever the American troops go, that's where the civil war goes with them. Mm-hmm. And in order to illustrate that, I want to take the example of a battle that is going on right now on Haifa Street. And the story behind Haifa Street is very interesting because it illustrates all of the horrible things that the United States is doing there and the way in which the U.S. is actually in the center of this civil war, sometimes fighting on both sides, but for sure causing the violence. Haifa Street is a Sunni area, vaguely speaking. If you go back far enough, you know, Baghdad is not divided between Sunni and Shia areas. Before the United States got there, that ethnic division was like Catholics and Protestants in the United States, right? This is all new, but it, mostly Sunnis live in Haifa. It's quite a prosperous neighborhood, right? It also is, it was a center of support for the insurgency, the resistance to the American occupation, the Sunni resistance, if you like. And so it was always a target of American troops, and in fact, they had a number of patrols there. A year ago, the American troops handed over Haifa Street to Iraqi troops. Now, that means they handed them over to the American-trained Shia forces, right? We're supposed to go in there and root out the insurgency. What does rooting out the insurgency mean? Well, what it means is that they get a list of people who are suspected insurgents, and they go to their homes. They don't knock on the door because the insurgent might shoot at them, right? So what they do is they blow the door open. They go storming into the house. Whoever is in there gets brutalized. Anyone resists, then they call in the air power and the tanks, and they blow the place up. That's what it means to go on patrol in these areas, right? So what happened was is that without all the American heavy artillery, what happened to the Iraqi army in that area was that the local resistance fought against the Iraqi military and expelled them. So Haifa Street became a center of resistance. And who was supplying the police there? The militias. You know, this whole thing, we've got to fight all the militias. What people don't seem to understand, what the American press will never publish, is that what the militias do in their own communities is supply law and order. They also happen to supply the resistance to the American patrols when the American patrols come into those communities. And more lately, when Iraqi military patrols go into Sunni areas, they supply the resistance to that, usually very effectively. The Iraqi military on its own cannot take on the Sunni resistance. So it became an area, the guerrillas would call it a liberated area, the Americans call it a center of the insurgency, which must be subdued, right? Now, what happened was is that once this initial foray of the Iraqi military was ended, there was an uneasy peace between the Haifa Street neighborhood and the surrounding neighborhoods, some of which were predominantly Shia. An uneasy peace, because in the Shia areas, they also have their militia, in this case, the Mahdi's army, right, which also defends their communities from who? They defend their communities from two sources, the Americans, who are more and more trying to go after the Mahdi's army, and the suicide bombers, who have a lot of trouble maneuvering in Shia neighborhoods with a heavy concentration of militias, Mahdi's army, because these guys are very sensitive. They live in the neighborhood. They know who's a stranger. They're very sensitive to who the strangers are. One of the things that isn't well known about the whole situation in Baghdad is up until recently, there were almost no suicide bombers in Sadr City because it was so well patrolled by the Mahdi's army. So you have these two defensive militias holding each other off, right? It's an uneasy truce. That stayed a truce until guess who showed up? The Americans. The Americans went into the Shia neighborhood next door to Haifa Street and arrested the leader of the Mahdi's army and took the Mahdi's off the street. It wasn't more than a couple of days later that that's tiny, and it is a tiny proportion, the tiny proportion of Sunnis who are into terrorism went into this Shia neighborhood and started attacking people, right? The Mahdi's were off the street, they couldn't protect the neighborhood, oh boy, let's get them. So the United States takes the Mahdi's off the street, opens up that neighborhood for Sunni terrorists to go in and start killing people, right? Now the Mahdi's army says, well, we have to retaliate, and they actually try to. There's an extensive militia in Haifa Street, right? And so these guys go in and they get repelled. On Tuesday morning, a week ago Tuesday morning, the Americans decided to take control of the situation. So what they did, 1,000 American and Iraqi troops went in to take down Haifa Street. And that's when the battle that got reported took place. Right? Now, the Americans act like they're going into this neighborhood to suppress violence, but actually what they're doing is going into this neighborhood to conquer it, right? And, of course, what happens is that when they go in, now when the Americans show up, they know they're in trouble. They know that all hell is going to break loose, that people's houses are going to be destroyed, that people, that any draft age, fighting age man is subject to arrest or murder by the American troops. They don't know who the insurgents are. They assume it's everybody and they go after everybody. So what happens is they have no choice but to fight, right? So there was a huge battle. And of course the American press has a way of describing these battles, right, that make it sound like, well, the Americans, you know, never hurt anybody, right? They only stop people from hurting each other. So here's a, but you know, some of these reporters are a little more honest than their editors, right? So here's a quote from the Times that says, the neighborhood is densely packed, making it difficult to strike targets from the air. So the fighter jets that were used, right, were just used to, quote, make a show of force, according to the military official. An attempt to frighten the gunmen from the rooftops, right? Okay. But the Washington Post reporter has a slightly different version of it. And here's a part of the Post report. This is the American commander speaking. We showed up in their living room for breakfast, Pearson said. About 7 a.m., the trouble began. As soon as the sun came up, the insurgents began shooting. He's there in the city, right? They come right into the center of the city. So then, it says, from the rooftops and doorways, the gunmen fired AK assault rifles and machine guns. Snipers also were targeting the U.S. and Iraqi soldiers. These are the soldiers that are pouring in from four sides of the community, right? It's only a mile long, this whole community, right? Okay, 1,000 soldiers are pouring in. U.S. soldiers started firing back with 50 caliber machine guns, right? These guys have AK-47s, which is a 22 caliber, right? 50 caliber machine guns mounted on their Stryker armored vehicles. They used TOW missiles, T-O-W missiles, Mark 19 grenade launchers, the F-15 fighter jets strafed rooftops with cannons, while the Apaches fired Hellfire missiles, right? The tagline to this is, but the insurgents kept fighting, which gives you an idea of how desperate they felt about what was going to happen to their community if they didn't keep fighting. But, of course, we know that most of the time, and this is what happened in this case, eventually the insurgents gave up, fled, the community was left half destroyed. Now, of course, law and order is restored, of course, right? That's what we have, right? What we have is we have a group of American soldiers and Shia soldiers who are recruited on the basis of being willing to be brutes, right? Most Shias are against this stuff, okay? Occupying Haifa Street, okay? Here's what it looks like a week later. This is a what is this from? This is from a McClatchy newspaper report, you know, the old Knight Ridder report. They have some very good reporters there, and one of them is this woman, Nancy Youssef, who always puts in the back of her articles, you want to see the real news, you go to the back of these long articles where the reporters are allowed to say a little more about what's going on. A 44-year-old Haifa Street resident who asked to be identified only as Abu Muhammad for security reasons said that only three or four families of an estimated 60 families remained on his block. Okay. He said no vehicles were allowed to drive through the area and there was no electricity, kerosene, or running waters. Snipers have taken positions on the rooftops. That's American snipers or Iraqi Shia snipers, right? They are shooting randomly, he said. Today they shot Ragad Marwan, a 28-year-old young woman who was just trying to get food. She got a bullet in her shoulder and now we don't know how to get her to the hospital because they can't go outside. He said several families were evacuating the neighborhood. I can see the families with their children walking in the narrow streets of the neighborhood taking nothing but small bags. The new security plan has given militias permission to go into our houses, this is the Shia apartments, and kill people, Abu Muhammad said. This plan targets Sunnis and forces them to leave their homes. Right? In another part of this article, they quote a government official saying, this neighborhood needs to be cleansed, right? Okay. Now, what are the American What do the Americans say about all these claims, right? U.S. officials downplayed the reports of all this brutality. U.S. Ambassador Zalwai Khalilzad and Army General George Casey told the Nukes conference that Iraqi officials had assured them that they'd target both Shiite and Sunni extremists in their efforts to pacify the city. I am encouraged by what I have seen. We need to give them the benefit of the doubt, and let's see what happened, Khalilzad said. And they also said they had investigated the claims about this particular event. A U.S. military spokesman said he had no reason to believe the Haifa Street residents' accounts. That was the result of his investigation. Now, look at the pieces of this, right? The U.S., if you think about this for just a couple of minutes, you see these things. You see that the U.S. goes in, right? It uses Shia troops to attack Sunnis. Some Sunnis become so infuriated. As a matter of fact, there is a common belief now in the Shia areas that, in the Sunni areas, that these Shia troops are trying to completely cleanse Baghdad, right? All Sunni are going to be gone. That's what people believe now, right? Is that all Sunni will be kicked out of Baghdad, their homes will be taken by the government that the United States has sponsored, right? That the American troops watch this happen, they don't do anything. They don't do anything. They just watch this happen, right? Okay? But they sponsored it. Now what you do is you get back, what the retaliation for this is, a small handful of Sunnis then become suicide bombers and go to Shia areas, right? And mayhem ensues. That's what you know for sure, that this attack in Baghdad against the Shia university is a retaliation for what's going on Haifa Street or one of the other neighborhoods in Baghdad. It's fancied as a retaliation. Granted, it's a crazy thing to do, and they shouldn't be doing it, but a small handful of Sunnis are willing to do this. Then the United States organizes these death squads to go in and kill Sunnis and drive them out of these areas. The United States is on both sides of this in many ways. They break down the defenses of the Shia areas to allow the suicide bombers in. They go into the Sunni areas, taking the Shia with them to go and slaughter the Sunnis. The United States is fighting both sides. The more that the United States is there, the more they will be able to do this. Right? Now, Anthony said, and they're escalating the war. They're talking about escalating the war now. This means they're going to go do more vicious things in Shia areas. Right? So there'll be a two-front war. Right? They're talking about attacking Iran. Right? And let me just revisit one other thing that Anthony said. He said, look, the Democrats are as responsible for this as anyone. The Democrats clearly, and I think it's a good thing that they're critical of the Bush administration, they're critical of this escalation. This escalation is going to kill tens of thousands of people, more than even the brutality that we see in a place like Haifa Street, right? They just put 20,000 more troops in there, they can do that much more slaughter, right? And foment even that much more. What are the Democrats actually saying? What is the ISG, the Baker Group, saying? What is Barack Obama actually saying? You know, what are they advocating? I just want to read you two quotes from Obama because, you know, he's currently the savior, right? Okay, he's the great man. This is from his major address in Chicago to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which is being quoted everywhere. And if you read it, it's beautifully. It's a beautiful address. The guy's a great speaker, and he's apparently a great writer, too, because this written version, you have to read it really carefully to unpack it. But I want you to hear a couple of things from it that I just find totally chilling, right, which gives us a sense of where the two sides of this debate are on. Here's his criticism of the president together with his own view. It may be politically advantageous for the president to simply define victory as staying and defeat as leaving, but it prevents a serious conversation about the realistic objectives we can still achieve in Iraq. The realistic objectives we can still achieve in Iraq. Now listen to what they are. Dreams of democracy and hopes for a perfect government are now just that, dreams and hopes. He's not for democracy in Iraq, okay? Right? Bravo. We must instead turn our focus to those concrete objectives that are possible to attain. Namely, preventing Iraq from becoming what Afghanistan once was, right? In other words, preventing Iraq from becoming a country that opposes the United States, right? Okay? Maintaining our influence in the Middle East, right? He's not for withdrawal, folks. He's saying we got to use an alternate strategy to maintain our influence, i.e. control in the Middle East, and forging a political settlement to stop sectarian violence so our troops can come home, right? Notice that he's connected the two, to stop sectarian violence so our troops can come home. What he's saying is we have to pacify the country first, then our troops can come home, right? That's translated, right? Here's, and I'll finish with this quote from the same speech. Drawing down our troops in Iraq will allow us to, this is, once he's got pacified the country, he's drawing down the troops, what's he going to do with them? Is he going to bring them home? No. This man does not want to bring the troops home. Drawing down our troops in Iraq will allow us to redeploy additional troops to northern Iraq. He doesn't even want to redeploy them out of Iraq. But wait, he's not done. And elsewhere in the region, right, he wants to occupy the Middle East. This force could help prevent the conflict in Iraq from becoming a wider war. Oh, okay. Right. We'll go into these places. Right? We'll do the same thing there as we did in Iraq. Consolidate gains in northern Iraq. Reassure allies in the Gulf, allow our troops to strike directly at Al-Qaeda wherever it may exist. This guy's talking about a region-wide war that he wants to fight and demonstrate to international terrorist organizations that they will not drive us from the region. Right? Okay. So his view is Bush is not ambitious enough.
Right.
Right. We have to really fight this global war on terror on a global basis. We have to fight everywhere, right? We have to be ready to strike everywhere. And Bush is emulating his strategy, right? Because the Somalia thing is exactly the kind of thing that Barack Obama is advocating and supporting. He said that was a great thing, right? And that's what the opposition is saying, right? So with opposition like that, you know, he needs Bush. So I think what we have to realize is that it's on us. It's on us. We have to do it ourselves. We can't hope for any of the established leadership to give us a break. And if we want to see this war come to an end and all this slaughter come to an end, we're going to have to stop them.
A military judge in Fort Lewis, Washington, declared a mistrial in the court-martial of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, the first commissioned officer prosecuted for refusing to go to Iraq. A new trial is believed to be unlikely before summer, if at all. The mistrial represents a significant victory for Watada, for the rights of military resistors, and for the movement of civil resistance to U.S. war crimes in Iraq. We go now to hear a powerful speech by Margaret Prescott, one of the founders of Women of Color in the Global Women's Strike and campaign coordinator with Friends and Families of Lieutenant Watada. Law and Disorder caught up with her tour in early December. Since then, the tour has garnered wide support from organizations, politicians, actors, and luminaries around the world. Let's have a listen.
Thank you so much. You could probably tell that I now live in Southern California, given how I'm bundled up. I am in shock. And I grew up in the Caribbean, so this is really very, very cold, very, very cold weather. And it really is terrific to see so many of you here on such a cold night. I know that was mentioned earlier, but I really just want to underscore that. We spoke with Lieutenant Watada earlier today, and he really was so, so grateful, expressed his appreciation for all of the support and all of the hard work, and he really honored the work of his mother. He was sure to really thank her for all of the work that she has done and how much he loves her. Thank you, Carolyn. You can clearly see that it is about defending Lieutenant Watada, and it's also about building a movement. And the movement of refuseniks is growing here in the United States, where the United States Army has actually admitted that over 8,000 military people have gone AWOL so they will not have to go to Iraq. If they tell us 8,000, you can imagine how many more they are. But there's a refuseniks movement around the world, in Turkey, in Israel, you know, in Morocco, in England, just about every country in the world, you will find a movement of people who are saying, no more will we go to war. Now, Lieutenant Ouattara does not describe himself as a conscientious objector. There are many in this room, including myself, who are against war. But that should not be a measure as to whether or not we will support Lieutenant Ouattara. You know, the United States has a very narrow definition of who is a conscientious objector. And Lieutenant Ouattara, in a broader definition, is indeed a conscientious objector. He is objecting to an unjust war. And there are people in Washington, D.C. who are trying to move legislation to broaden the definition of who is a conscientious objector to make it easier for people like Lieutenant Ouattara to be able to say no to an unjust war. And of course, there are us, the movement, who are saying no against war altogether. The other thing I wanted to point out, and you see in the poster, the really lovely poster, he's such a lovely young man. I always have to refer to that because I'm a mama, you know, and here's the woman who produced him, you know. He's just one. Isn't he wonderful? You know, just, and a leader, really very, very much a, you know, very much a leader. But you can see references made to the Constitution. Now, there's some of us who know about the flaws of the Constitution. You just got to look at me, and you know I know the flaw, all right? The time that sucker was written, you know, my ancestors were slaves, okay? And when the Haitian Revolution happened more than 200 years ago and defeated Napoleon's army, the greatest army in the world, equivalent of the U.S. Army of today, and this was before the Emancipation Proclamation of the United States. The United States made sure they led a 60-year economic boycott against the first black republic, the first country in the world that was born by a revolution of those enslaved that we know about in modern times. That is Haiti, by the way. And that's one of the reasons that Haiti has remained a mess until today, because it has to be the example of what not to do. But this is connected to the point that I want to make about the Constitution. Nevertheless, we were left out. You know, women know what we've had to go through to get the vote. But nevertheless, there is a clause in the Constitution that says international treaties agreed to or signed on to by this government is the supreme law of the land. Y'all hear what I'm saying? Because all those people that run around talking about patriotism, waving flags and red state and blue state and all that kind of stuff, okay, have to realize that this is what the Constitution says. That includes the UN Charter. That includes the Nuremberg trials, the principles that came from that effort. If indeed that is the law of the land, Lieutenant Ouattara has committed no crime. And I could tell you that in Washington, D.C., those elected officials are hiding behind the technicality. Their position is, even if they want to go as far as saying, Lieutenant Ouattara is a courageous young man. You know, you're supposed to bow down and kiss their feet because that's what they said, if you would believe this. Not ready to do anything, mind you. But they also say he has broken the law. And even the ones who are ready to say, okay, there is a public debate, a debate that's supposed to be going on in Congress about whether or not that war was a legal war, and may even go as far to say, well, yes, maybe it wasn't a legal war, are still saying, okay, if you say the war is illegal, you still have to say what Lieutenant Ouattara did, it's illegal because he disobeyed orders. Well, excuse me. We, the people, have got to set another standard. if it is an illegal war and you are being forced to go and fight and participate in war crimes, the Nuremberg Principle says you are held responsible. You know, that young woman, Lindy England, I think her name was, that participated in the Abu Ghraib torture, which, by the way, another thing we must know, that torture that took place in Abu Ghraib is homegrown, you know. What do you think they were doing to Black Panthers that they were picking up? You know, I've interviewed on my show, Sojourner Truth, Panthers that were tortured in New Orleans 30 years ago using some of these same methods, okay? You know, so this stuff is not new. It has been practiced right here in the United States, and it is now being exported. But she was a scapegoat of sorts, because very much her superiors were involved in that, and that goes all the way up to Rumsfeld, and it goes all the way up to the White House. All of us in this room know that, okay? We have to make sure that we are supporting those within the U.S. military who are subverting the military, who are refusing to fight unjust wars, who are refusing to say no, just as we saw those soldiers in Vietnam do in that film, Sir, No, Sir. Okay? So we really want to call on each and every one of you to make sure that when you leave this room, it's not about seeing a nice video and seeing a nice film and, you know, you feel good for a few moments. But I know that there's some serious organizers among you, you know, who are out there doing that work and really pleading with you that whatever work you do, be sure that support for Lieutenant Watada is there. You know, a lot of people have seen we don't have the leadership of a Martin Luther King, of a Malcolm X. It seems every time we create as working people a leader, they just shoot them down. They just kill them down and make sure, you know, we don't have anybody. Well, we have some leadership in this young lieutenant. You could clearly hear that. You could see how he's putting things together. You could see how he's concerned about Africa because he's talking about proxy wars. You could see how he's concerned about Black and brown communities because he is talking about the poverty draft. He has done his homework. He understands some things, and he understands the importance of those of us from different communities, different economic backgrounds coming together, because that is the way that we're going to stop war. So this is really an appeal and a call to action for all of you, and that as a movement, we have a responsibility not only to build our own organizations, not only to use the case of Lieutenant Watada to increase membership in our specific organizations. It is about building a movement and being accountable to Lieutenant Watada, to Carolyn Ho, and to those who are central in his case, because that is how we are going to build solidarity. That is how we're going to build unity. Thank you very much. Yeah.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.